Good evening. So tonight I'd like to speak around and explore how do we cultivate equanimity? How do we cultivate this quality of equanimity? So equanimity, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, is this sense of being equally close to all things, to all experience, to all beings, to all aspects of life, this sense of being equally close. As I spoke about last week, it's not so helpful to pretend to have equanimity, not to pretend that I'm adopting that as a state of mind or as a quality I want to assume. It's not so helpful to do that when we start to manufacture some imitation of what equanimity seems to be, a sense of being a little contrived, because it sets up this internal pressure within us. We're trying to be calm and being very balanced in our experience, and yet internally we're not, then we're stuck with having to have this either repression or trying to negate it, or go into a sense of distance or aloofness. So it's not so helpful, and this is this aspect we explored 2 weeks ago. So equanimity really rises of its own accord. It's a set of conditions that come together, and at one moment you may feel a sense of equanimity, either at the next moment, perhaps not. But there's a way we can cultivate equanimity, create the conditions that encourage equanimity to naturally arise. And so tonight we'll explore three practices or three approaches we can use to help encourage and develop equanimity, to create these conditions for it to naturally arise. The first one is mindfulness. It's this basic quality of mindfulness, and highlighting two qualities of how we meet each moment with non-resistance and also without a lot of cognitive layer, without a lot of thought. Investigation is the next one. So this quality of how do we use the very rub of life, the times we're not having equanimity arising, how do we use those times to actually reveal much deeper holding, much deeper binding, because it shows how we're identified in this moment's experience. And finally, disenchantment. As we see very clearly, as we see our lives without the fog of delusion, we start to see that enough is enough. And through that disenchantment, naturally equanimity starts to rise, starts to be more and more present. So this first quality of mindfulness, we can say we practice mindfulness, we do this all the time. So I'd like to highlight these two qualities of non-resistance to this moment's experience, and also this quality of not being oriented toward the cognitive, toward thought. And we talked about experience, I think it's helpful to kind of unpack that word for a moment. So when I use the word experience in this context, it's meaning any moment of sense data. Okay, a sight, a sound, a taste, a touch, a thought. These are all experiences that are arising. You know, sometimes I also use this as a much broader sense, like life's experience, or the experience of getting married or getting divorced or having a loved one die. But often when we talk about experience, it's this one moment's arising. How do we meet this moment? With either wisdom or with ignorance. So if we define equanimity as being equally close to all beings, to all things, then the opposite of equanimity is trying to be not so close to some things and closer to other things. We're kind of being selectively close and further away. Another way to say this is being reactive. Being caught in this sense of reactivity, pushing something away that we don't like, pulling something closer that we want more of. And this quality of being reactive, inherent in this, is this sense of movement, this sense of this urge to act, to do something, to think about it, to speak about it, to move our bodies in relationship to this, moving away, moving against. And equanimity has this quality of being still, of being quiet in the midst of our experience, in the midst of whatever is arising. And so equanimity is cultivated as we practice being still. Meditation is not bounded by a particular posture or a particular activity. It's really a relationship to life. And yet, as we practice it, having a formal sitting practice, sitting still, having more of a sense of turning inward can be very helpful. Because that stillness of the body starts to train us how to be still inwardly, how to meet what's arising with a quality of stillness. So at first, we're trying to do that. I'm trying to be still with this thought, with this irritation, with this restless body. Okay, I'm trying to be still with it. But eventually we start to realize it's not us who's trying to be still, it's actually stillness itself. And we're trying to surrender to allow stillness itself to be what's meditating, what's perceiving, what's relating to this moment's experience. And so as you all know, if you've practiced at any length of time, that you sit and it's not just an easy, calm experience. You know, the body has these waves of sensation going through it, often itching, unpleasantness, achingness, numbness. The emotionality comes forth, mental proliferation, keep getting lost in thought. And we learn how to keep coming back again and again. This coming back starts to cultivate equanimity. We start to cultivate this quality of being okay with whatever is here. Often in the beginning class, I encourage people to practice every day, because every day you start to learn the different weather systems of your mind. It's like if we only went out in Seattle when it was sunny and clear, we only have a limited experience of this area. But if we're able to go out in all areas, all types of weather, and meet that, then we're building this capacity to hold all of life. So too with our own bodies, with our own minds. If we sit every day, we develop this capacity to meet the times when we're calm, when we're peaceful, when we're agitated, when our minds are filled with grief. And as we do that, the waves of reactivity move through, the waves of impulse, and if we're willing to be still with it, it starts to loosen their power. Otherwise, if we keep, every time we have an itch or something, we shift and move, we start to reinforce that reactivity. Now, how we remain still, though, is essential. It's essential to look at the attitude of meditation. What are we bringing to that? You know, how strong is our agenda? I remember often in the early days of my own practice, it felt like there was a lot of will that was needed to stay, you know, seated for the 30 minutes or 40 minutes I was practicing. Because the mind just kept pulling me away, keep coming back. So there's a sense of, okay, I'm going to sit still. A lot of really willpower was needed in those early days, a sense of grit, this willingness to be with that, the courage to be with whatever is arising. But toughing it out only goes so far. And there's a point we start to find that it creates too much tension in the midst of our practice. The tension becomes predominant. It starts to color what we're seeing. And we start to realize something else has to come through. We can't keep forcing ourselves to be still. There's this almost a crisis as we release that need to be so in charge. And then meditation starts to run itself. Mindfulness starts to happen itself. And when this starts to happen, then equanimity starts to naturally arise. You know, the Buddha's story before he became the Buddha, he practiced very, very intensely, very austerely. He would, you know, sit for hours, would even at one point eat very little food, just whatever would fall on his lap while he was eating, while he was sitting, that was what he would literally eat. So he became more and more starved, basically. And at one point he just noticed that he was becoming so weak. And he reflected back when he was a child, and he was watching his father work on the orchard underneath the rose tree. He was sitting there and just saw his mind was very balanced, very relaxed, very spacious, but also at the same time, very attentive. And he realized maybe that's the quality of mind that's needed, not the sense of striving, of forcing my body to be a certain way. And that became the basis that he went in and continued to become enlightened. So it's always this balancing act of how much effort do we stay on the cushion to meet whatever is arising. And really the effort goes back again and again to non-resistance. So it's almost a paradox. How can you apply effort to have non-resistance, to relaxing? So eventually you start to realize that effortling to try to relax doesn't make sense. So this quality of non-resistance is really learned in practice, you know, in the formal practice. And it's interesting to just to play with that, to play with the urges, the waves to move. And if I can be still with that, can I relax with that? You start to see that builds this capacity to meet experience. This is building the capacity for equanimity. So this non-resistance. The other quality to talk about tonight is this quality of non-thinking or non-cognitive. So here equanimity, the sense of not having preferences, not having a sense of, okay, it's okay with whatever is arising. But if we have this thought, I shouldn't have preferences, we've already created a preference for not having preferences. You know, it's very slippery how quickly thought comes in. Right? Thought comes in very quickly. You say, oh, I'm not supposed to have preferences. That's my preference, to not have preferences. So this quickly becomes an unsolvable problem, an unsolvable task. It's like saying to a dog, I want you to catch your tail. And so the dog starts chasing its tail. And the faster it goes, the faster the tail goes. And the dog says, okay, maybe I'll slow down and go very slowly. And move an inch, and the tail moves an inch. It becomes impossible to have thought try to relieve thought. So the practice asks us to orient ourselves before thought arises. To orient before thought arises, right? To really learn what equanimity is, we have to be willing to go before thought. If thought's already arisen, which it often has, how can we shift our perspective from the details of the foreground to the spaciousness of the background? So even right now, whatever thought is happening in your head, in your experience, can you shift to what's observing that, to what's knowing that thought? And you keep reorienting to that place. In this way, as we work with whatever is arising, whether it's something we like or don't like, and that sense of wanting to move with it, the spirit changes from willpower to one of surrender, a sense of relaxing the entire body. If we're able to step outside of thought or orient before thought, we can step into this sense of complete surrender to whatever this moment's unfolding, whatever is here. This is very different than surrendering to the story or what's happening, to the history that's around it. Often when something arises and it feels very charged, feels very difficult, like I just can't hold this. If you look closely, it's the story that makes it so hard. Even more exactly, it's what it means about you that makes it so difficult. The meaning that you place upon it. Or say, oh, this is something very personal about me. So this sense of just letting that float, the story float, and shifting before the thought arises. Then the body leads. The body opens to this point of resistance, this experience, this anger, this fear, frustration, letting the whole body feel it, and letting the mind take a break. So it almost feels like settling into a hot bath. You know, at first it's uncomfortable, but there's a point where you kind of relax into it. The muscles start to soften with that. So often something very intense, like a sense of anger, a sense of fear, if I can release the story around it and go to the felt sense in the body, then there's this way of relaxing with it. In that relaxing, you learn equanimity. Maybe not at first, but it creates these conditions to allow equanimity to naturally arise. The key, again, is not to orient in the cognitive, not to orient in the thought, but in the felt sense in the body. Of course, just like a bath, sometimes the water is too hot, right? You try to go into it, and it's just too hot to go into. And often emotions have so much intensity. Physical pain, if we have enough intensity or enough chronic nature of it, you know, it's hard to open to. So learning how to just put our hands over that water and feel it, or start to cool it down, bringing a sense of cold water to it. The cold water in this analogy is finding something in this moment which you can relax with. What is there possible to relax with in this moment? It might be sound. It might be something very different than this charge. You see how we're working with this quality meeting experience without resistance, without thought. So in this way, mindfulness starts to cultivate the qualities, the conditions for equanimity to naturally arise. Now the next kind of practice is investigation. Investigation, or inquiry. And this turns, if we shift our perspective that I need to be a good practitioner, I have to have equanimity all the time, right? If we're willing to just notice when it's arising and when it's here and when it's not, just to work with the moment's experience. So when equanimity is not accessible, when it is far removed, instead of fighting with ourselves, instead of judging ourselves for not being up to the task, for not being more perfect, we can actually see the preciousness of that reactivity. Actually see how that reactivity itself, if we listen well, reveals something very important about ourselves. It shows us the exact pattern of how we're identifying in that moment around that issue. And if we follow that down to the root of it, we see identification that's at the root of many things. See, this gift of reaction, of when we are reactive, if we stop trying to make ourselves be not human, to allow ourselves to have this whole range of being human, when those reactions arise, we learn to turn toward that with compassion, with attention, to see where we identify. This is the whole point of investigation, is to see exactly where we're identifying, where we're forming a sense of I, a sense of me, a sense of mine. It's not about forming a new story around ourselves. Sometimes this is perhaps how psychological work differs from Dharmic work, because they often follow the same terrain. But perhaps with the psychological, we may tend to form a new sense of self. It may be a more healthy sense of self, a more, you know, functional sense of self, which is very important. But the Dharma looks at it not from forming a new sense of self, but unpacking the sense of self, of starting to disentangle that very belief, that illusion. And when the story arises, often it comes up in this sense of reactivity that comes up that's more than we can relax with, because it has quite a bit of meaning. And if we look closely, we see how it shapes the very way we're interfacing with the world, how we're creating the world, how we interpret someone's yawn, someone's gesture, or something like that, as something that means about me. It feeds back into that. And we look at this, as we explore this, I'm going to take a side trip for a second, exploring these three words of mindfulness, of investigation, and awareness. Right? So those three words, especially mindfulness and awareness, I think it's important to just define how we use that, because Narani particularly used them in a different way than is often used. And I, as a student, follow that. So mindfulness we can think of as this core relationship to experience, of relating to it with a steadiness of attention and a non-reactivity, a sense of complete allowing it to be as it is. It tends to be more focused. I'm going to focus on this experience, on this breath, although we can be mindful in a much more spacious way. There's often a sense of me directing that mindfulness, of me saying, I'm going to choose to focus, to pay attention versus not. And ideally it has a quality of surrendering, of non-resistance to whatever's arising. If you think of it as a flashlight, so I'm taking a flashlight and shining it at one object at a time, right? Or maybe a broader sweep, holding a few objects at a time. Now investigation, I often think of it as directed mindfulness. Intentional mindfulness. So the same quality of non-resistance, of compassion, of non-agenda of looking. Investigation then directs that in a particular way, particularly toward this sense of me, this sense of self, how I'm forming in this. So the investigation takes that flashlight of mindfulness and directs it to where am I getting caught? Where am I creating a sense of me? The sense of self is a very subtle kind of background thing. You have to have a lot of stillness to be able to see that, even perceive that. Yet, its actions are what we live with all day. So actually seeing where we get charged, where we get emotional, where we get caught, and just being still with that, directing our attention to that, naturally starts to allow that to deepen, to see the deeper layers. And if you follow it all the way down, you can start to see that sense of self. As an example, just from last week, my wife and I were doing this relationship exercise and talking about different things we kind of felt gritchy about, a sense of unease about in our relationship. And I brought up this, it seems like a kind of a silly thing, but she had cleaned our laundry room and moved these clothespins someplace, you know, and it made sense to her. But for years, I always knew where the clothespins were. I mean, I just knew, okay, this is where they are. And it was it really brought up a lot of stuff, disorienting when this happened. This happened years ago, but it still brought up stuff. So I thought, let's explore this, you know, and how we can cohabitate, how we can work together as householders. And so there's the initial quality of feeling that, you know, what am I really feeling? That sense of being out of control, of not, you know, feeling angry, feeling shocked, disoriented. Taking full ownership of that, and not blaming her, but taking ownership. And as I worked with that, there's a point where you look at what is the background trigger, the archaic trigger. And what came to mind is this sense when I was probably 10 or 11, and just sitting in my room and feeling this deep grief, reflecting on death, and reflecting on my grandmother dying, and different loved ones dying, and just feeling the fear and the sadness of people that I wanted to stay my life being taken away from me. And just that sense of helplessness. And I felt, okay, that's that connection with that sense of, I always know where these clothespins were, and now they're not. I always know where this person is, and now they're not. So it took me to the much, much deeper quality of this existential fear of impermanence, of things always changing. And when I touched upon that in a very precise way, a very direct way, a very emotional way, then suddenly the clothespins, it doesn't really matter. It freed that whole thing up. And yet so much of our lives, we get caught in those clothespins, arguing about where they should be and where they shouldn't be, and how could you do that? But if I was able to look at that, I could see there was actually a gift to show this much deeper quality. Right? So by doing that, then equanimity naturally starts to arise. Right? Being willing to hold these deep pains. So looking at the past, you know, on one hand, it's we can say it's not helpful because we can't change it. We can't go back and make it a different past. It's already happened. But on the other hand, so much of the times the past is keep intruding upon the moment, on this present. It's really shaping how we're interacting with each other, with ourselves. And learning to touch exactly how that happens, if we touch it in the right way, with this idea of loosening the conditioning, the identification, then it really loosens the whole process. And it's very essential to do this. And for myself, investigation comes in this way, when I feel that inability to be present, to really show up, to want life to be a certain way, to want me to be a certain way, that calls investigation. So mindfulness follows along with it. It's really feeling it in the body. So you're observing the cognitive, these deep beliefs, but without becoming caught in it. I don't know if you could see there's a slight difference. If I start to look at those and I start to get caught in it and make a whole new story around it, it's not so helpful. It's like, oh, it's so sad that I was that young, I was already grieving the end of life and all that. But if I'm able to just feel that without having to add anything more to it, then that's the power of investigation. Now if we move, as I started to do this little segue, talking about mindfulness, that steadiness of attention, investigation is that more directed quality. Then awareness, what is awareness in this context? Awareness in some ways is the aim of the practice, the aim of investigation. Because when we start to see these deep levels of identification, where we're placing ourselves as I, me, and mine, we really see that and see it just as another thought, we see it inherently as empty, then we start to see not from that place of identification, but we're starting to see from awareness itself. From the, what seeing is actually is there's no reference point internally. It's like this shift from the flashlight to the lights in the room that's bathing everything and everyone equally. In this way, equanimity is naturally present. It's naturally here. So as we soften and see through this illusion of self, equanimity naturally arises. The more we're caught in the sense of self, in our reactivity, the further away equanimity will be. You know, in Buddhism, we have this idea of fetters, these different fetters of clinging, of craving, of delusion. And these fetters are what keeps the sense of self really intact. So when I think of these, often and in terms of investigation, I often recall experiences when I've had to move a plant or take out a root, a stump from a tree. So if you've ever had to do that, and if you're doing it the old-fashioned way, just with a shovel and an axe, you start to dig all the way around it, right? You test it, and it's very sturdy, doesn't move at all. And you dig a little deeper around it, and you find a big root, and you cut that root, and it still doesn't move at all. And you dig a little deeper, and there's another root, and you cut that. And then eventually you start to find a root that starts to loosen the whole process, but you can still feel very solid. And you keep going through, digging underneath more and more, till the final root is cut and everything just is released. So the same quality with investigation is finding those roots, following those own roots in ourselves. And our reactivity reveals where those roots are. As long as we're not judging ourselves for having that reactivity. If we judge ourselves, then we don't see that. It's like we're putting more dirt back on that root ball. But if we see, okay, this reactivity is actually showing me the shape of these roots. I'm willing to see, okay, how far do they go? Okay, and what happens when those are seen through? And the equanimity is just a byproduct of that seeing. So mindfulness, investigation, and finally disenchantment. Disenchantment is an interesting word. It shows up a fair amount in the suttas. And just that word itself, that sense of being disenchanted, it's like someone has taken away the spell that's obscuring reality. You're waking up from that spell. And when we're in the spell, we can't see clearly. So both mindfulness and investigation cultivate this clear seeing, this very direct seeing. That clear seeing starts to wake us up from this enchantment. You know, become disenchanted. And disenchantment starts to have this other quality we just start to see the kind of the fertility of looking for happiness in places where it just can't be found. Looking for happiness in the absence of something, in the presence of something. Because we say, okay, that I keep trying that strategy over and over again. But it doesn't pan out. So seeing that clearly, we start to naturally see from equanimity. We start to become naturally more equally near all things. The sense of always chasing reactivity. Our reactivity, like I said at the beginning, has this impulse to move, to do something with. Right? So we keep doing it. Remember, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. Right? So how do we switch that? How do we wake up from that? Because so often we don't. We go through our whole lives, and the end of our lives still finding ourselves as caught in reactivity as we were, perhaps even more caught. And some of us will find that's very different, that we actually find reactivity loosening, becoming less and less so. You know, as the 12-step wisdom talks about that sense of hitting bottom. Sometimes we have to keep trying that to the point it doesn't make any more sense. Our whole life, our whole world is collapsing around us. There's a famous story, a Zen story, about a farmer who had a son and a horse. And one day the horse runs away. Right? And all the neighbors come over to consolidate him, to console him, I should say, and say, you know, it's such a tragedy, you lost your horse, how are you going to plow the fields? And the farmer said in response, yeah, maybe yes, maybe it's a tragedy, maybe it's not. Right? And the next day the horse comes back with a second horse. So I found a wild horse, and all the neighbors are saying, this is great, such great luck, you're so blessed. And the farmer says, maybe yes, maybe no. And the next day, the son gets on the horse to try to train it, and it falls off and breaks his leg. And all the friends come over and say, oh, this is such bad luck, your son's leg is shattered. And he says, maybe yes, maybe no. And the next day, the army comes and drafts all the young men, and the young man, because his leg's broken, can't go. They say, well, this is such luck. Maybe yes, maybe no. Yeah. So this story, it's not about being pessimistic or optimistic. You know, it's really about the sense of relaxing the mind's need to predict the future. To see if something arises, maybe this is good fortune, maybe it's not. But can I just meet it? Do I have to say what's going to happen in the future? This is part of this releasing the cognitive, being willing to release the story of what the future would be. When your equanimity is naturally arising, notice that there's not a future. There's not a past. There's just what's here. And that's enough. There's not this movement forward or back. Another process of disenchantment that happens. And disenchantment is this, it's similar to equanimity, it just naturally starts to arise. It's hard to force yourself to get disenchanted. If you're trying to force yourself, you're going to tie yourself in a knot pretty quickly. But through clearing, seeing clearly and opening to life, seeing directly, paying attention to the life's lessons, it naturally starts to come in to your experience, the way of being in the world. There's this other quality, though, that as we follow those tree roots down and we start to loosen those fetters, we start to loosen this this strong belief in the sense of self, we start to see gaps in that sense of self when that falls away, when the sense of self is not seen as so porous, when it actually is seen as when it does fall away. We start to see that our lives start to change. We don't find ourselves pursuing the same things that we used to always love to do. We don't find ourselves, you know, fighting against things we didn't like so much. And what happens is that you could say the sense of self or the ego needs a certain fuel. Right? It needs a fuel of not enough, of the insufficiency of the moment. It depends upon that. It needs that insufficiency to kind of keep itself engaged. When the sense of self falls away or loosens or is transcended temporarily or permanently, then those strategies to feed it don't make sense anymore. You know, perhaps we could say it's analogy like in the turn of the century when, you know, you go through the city and there'd be horses everywhere. And there'd be all the industry, the blacksmiths to take care of the horses and the stalls and all the stuff they do for horses. And we started getting cars, all that stopped being so necessary. It started to really fall away. Right? So the mechanism, the machine of the sense of self, when it's obsolete, when it's no longer needed, all the supporting structure is no longer needed. And this becomes a quality of disenchantment. What we found so alluring, that was so vital for our lives, starts to fall away. Right? And it's not a sense of being, you know, sometimes it can feel kind of like a sense of barrenness, but it's often just temporary. There's a deeper quality of just equanimity, a sense of just simply being equally close, equally near all things. So equanimity can't be forced. We can't make ourselves be an equanimous person. We can't allow it. We can't force that. Trying to make ourselves do that, trying to trick ourselves into being someone like that, trying to adopt that, can be detrimental, cause more problems. But it can be cultivated. It can be cultivated. You know, this very word, meditation, is actually, in the Pali canon, it's called bhavana, which is a better translation as cultivation. It's like you're creating the soil and you're seeing what's going to grow from that. So these three qualities of mindfulness, the sense of relaxing with this moment's experience, with non-resistance, with steadiness of attention, being willing to not move with whatever's arising, being willing to relax the cognitive, the thought process, to just let the body feel this moment's experience. This is a great cultivator of equanimity. Investigation, using the very reactivity, the very absence of equanimity as a signal, as a cue to pay attention, to find out where exactly are those deep roots. And following them down, you see the identification and seeing if those can be released. And disenchantment, it's really this result of clear seeing that chasing after doesn't work, as the fuel of reactivity has no machine of self, equanimity naturally arises. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. as we're sitting, without any agenda of what should be here, just meet it. Welcome it. Can the body fully relax into it? And when there's a moment of complete surrender, equanimity is naturally here, naturally present. So thank you. So I'd like to just give a few words about the practice and reflection. So this is a chance for you, an invitation for you, to take the talk and the topic of the talk and bring it into your daily life. You know, to really bring it into, to make it your own, to see, you know, does this make sense? Is this applicable? You know, to see it for yourself. So bring a renewed commitment of non-resistance to your practice, both on the cushion and outside the cushion. Sometimes the reactivity is much more accessible in relationship, in connection with other people, right? So how can I make that part of my practice just as much as sitting formally? So release this cognitive relationship with experience and shift to a body-centered connection. So again, when I say experience, it's whatever this moment's arising. It could be an itch, it could be a sadness, it could be a reactivity, upsetness, it could be whatever it is. Whatever is present, that's this moment's experience. Soften the normal ideas around it, the normal way of trying to figure it out, navigate it. And see instead if you can open to your body, completely feeling it, completely opening to it. Now, as areas of charged reactivity arise, you know, either just practicing or life rubbing up against you, bring a quality of embodied investigation to meet that. Embodied investigation means you're leading with the body, you're feeling it in the body, not leading with the mind, the thought. The thoughts guide you, the cognitive guides you, but it's the body that's really opening to what's present. See if you can trace the deep root systems that create a sense of I, of me, of mine. And notice if these practices cultivate a deeper quality of equanimity. So bring your attention to that. I think equanimity is probably more present than you give yourself credit for. Just notice times when you're not chasing something, you're not moving towards something or away from something. Notice how the mind has this quality of equanimity, being equally near all things. Bring your attention to that, it starts to highlight it. It starts to cultivate it, arising more and more. So we have some time for any dialogue and comments, questions about equanimity, about the talk, about anything. Yes, Rob. Right.
And that was, you know, that was an insight. That was so the question I mean is, how can I practice investigation? Is it something that I practice in the moment, or, you know, only later, so that, you know, if I have more time, I guess, think about it. And how can I do investigation in a way that, you know, promotes
okay, so let's see if I got that question. This is around investigation. And how do you do that in the moment when it arises, or is it something that you do later? And then how do you use investigation to help promote qualities of insight? Like the story when I shared about seeing the clothespins and the deeper connections with that. Well, investigation, first of all, it's important to give yourself patience around it. You know, not to have a sense of time, like, okay, if I can't get it right now, then it's not worth it. There's been times when I've had to really spend literally months, you know, working with a particular sticky thing that was very charged. So that's one thing to kind of relax with. And the sense of leaning into and in trying to find an insight to arise. In some ways, it's like we're trying to have an invite, and we're kind of going to, okay, where is there an insight that's here that can kind of make it further away? It can be a little, it's like a spontaneous aha that arises. So trying to make yourself spontaneous doesn't work as so well, right? So it's more like really creating the conditions. The caveat is the more that you're able to do that, and naturally you start to orient that way. You start to feel the flavor of it. Okay, and so these are all kind of backgrounds, things with your question. Now to get to the core of the question, well, one part was whether to do it right now or to do it later. So it's whenever it's really present is the best time to do it, given that you have enough time to really work with it. There's a certain amount of precision that's helpful. I think, like with my wife and I, we had this very structured thing we were going through, and having to really articulate it to another person was very helpful. So if you have that in your life, that's great. But you can also write it out very clearly. You know, what is, you know, just say, okay, I'm, just any emotion, I am angry that this is happening, right? So you write that out, and then you feel, okay, where is this in my body right now? Where is it showing up? And you be still with that. And you may write a little bit more about it, okay, because it's, you know, I feel it's so unjust. And just kind of feel that, write it, articulate what's happening there. And after you do that for a while, you can say, is this remind me of something from my past? Does this feel like a deeper connection? Right? And then it may just naturally arise, or maybe like, oh, it's, I don't really feel anything. It's just my boss's fault. It's nothing to do with the past, for example. But then you say, well, you know, that kind of reminds me of when my dad did that. Okay, and then you articulate that and you feel it. So it's like for me it often feels like I'm going through this underground cave system, and I find a room and I shine in my lights, feeling, you know, the emotions in the body, feeling the sensations in the body, feeling the deep beliefs, all right? And if I keep doing that and keep being very sensitive and listening without an agenda, then maybe a new room opens up, right? But the key thing with investigation is not to elaborate upon the story, but just to see how that past history is showing up right now, right? That past history is shaping how I see things. So instead of seeing the person how they are now, it's really filtered through my past. And the reason to do that, again, the bigger orientation is to loosen this identification. It's really making the unconscious more conscious. Because most of us go around with such a level of unconscious behavior and actions, and it's very much tied to these deeper beliefs, deeper wounding, really, that creates these deep root systems of the sense of self, the sense of identity. Right? And so notice also when you see it differently, when you say, oh, it's really not my boss, it's my father. Okay, and notice how that kind of is a little disorienting. It's a little disorienting. The disorientation is often a landmark of that sense of self loosening up a bit. Kind of the solidity of the world starts to become loosened. You start to become a little disenchanted. Does that help? Yeah. Yes, Iris.
Understanding a little bit more about not self. Don't put me out here.
since the election, just to sort of talk about the role and how we're engaging and so forth. And at the very beginning of the evening, one person was talking about all the things that the president was doing wrong. And I can be a harsh and judgmental thinker. And you know, I didn't really realize that I was getting worked up because I didn't want the conversation to go on about, you know, what he's doing wrong, but more about how we're engaging in the world. And before I realized what was going on and that I was going to say something inappropriate, I said something inappropriate. And I said something like, well, can we sort of not continue to complain about what's going on and talk about how we're engaging the world? But I said it in a harsher way than was kind, what was called. And, you know, as it was coming out, I realized that. And I said to this person, I said, I'm sorry, did I offend you? And this person said, yes. And I said, I really apologize. I can be harsh that way, and I apologize. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like a piece of crap.
Mm. Which is different.
And today, you know, in thinking about it, I didn't feel like a piece of crap. And it was, I mean, I don't want to speak like that to people. But it was, and I'm taking this course online on emptiness with Guy Armstrong right now. And, you know, he said a lot of things that I'm reading and hearing about. And so I just felt like this loosening. You know, the identification of Irish, you're so judgmental, and you know you're so mean when you talk to people. I'm not always mean, you know, but
right.
and so it was just kind of cool to just feel some space.
Yes. Yeah.
And not my habitual, you know, kind of.
So, yeah. Yeah, beautiful. Let me just repeat that for the people listening, and then I'll comment on that. So the comment was, being with a group that's meeting every month after the election, which, you know, that's to be applauded, just to have that endurance. I mean, you know. But you know, it's like we laugh, but you know, just think how everyone felt, you know, right after the election, like, okay, we're going to do this. But how many of us are still engaged in that way? So that's wonderful. Just the intent, just I want to say that, to honor that. So there's a sense of someone talking about, complaining about the president, and you wanted to shift it. So there came out kind of a judgmental way of shifting it. And then you realized, okay, that, as you said it, that was judgmental and harsh. And then you apologized. But the part that was very different was that normally that would have created a lot of backlash, a lot of self-judgment, a self-reinforcing that belief that I'm a piece of, I won't say it for the internet, but and that felt very freeing, you know. And so is that loosing identification or a sense of equanimity? And I think it's really the identification piece. And you can see the freedom from that. How our identification, what we take as I and me and mine, it's not like this, you know, this is my hat, and it's like that. But we take that I'm a piece of crap, that's a very deep quality. And then to have a behavior come out when you stepped on someone's toes and said something harsh and you apologized, but you didn't reinforce that belief. And that's really that disentanglement of that sense of self. So really, you know, soak in that sense. Really relax and enjoy that quality of loosening. I mean, this is a practice of greater and greater freedom, greater and greater joy. And you get a great taste of that. And it's and you couldn't have predict you couldn't you didn't like say, oh, don't be judgmental of yourself. It just didn't stick in the same way. So something has loosened that connection. So it's like one of those roots has been taken away. Yeah, and it does, you know, in terms of equanimity, I want to put that a perfect framing on that, but you can see that starts to lead more and more toward that. When you said that, and instead of making a big thing about what it means about you, it's like, okay, I made a mistake. And you can see how equanimity does come in. It allows you to navigate life much more gracefully, make amends, but you don't have to, you know, crucify yourself. Yeah, so that's lovely. Thank you for sharing that. Yes.
The recent thing that I've had lately, just a couple of instances of thinking about that's been a shock to me, is that I have been aware in that moment of disappointment in myself that there's an expectation back there that I will do everything perfectly at all times.
Yes.
And I've had a couple of reactions to that. One of them being immense relief. If I just let it go by, oh. But then I felt some disappointment. You know, like, wow, it's not going to be perfect.
Yes. So the comment is noticing kind of the stance that everything has to be perfect. And when you saw that, it was no longer this unconscious program, right? And there's a sense of relief, like, okay, I don't have to be so in charge. But there's also this sense of disappointment that things won't be perfect as I want. And that's an important thing to realize, too, is that these deep beliefs, they have such grip because they're not just, they have payoffs, right? They have things that we really, that we get from them, right? And that can be very helpful when it feels very sticky, is to see what's the payoff from this belief, right? So if I know what's perfect, then I can judge everybody. No one's doing it my way. There's a lot of, you know, self-reinforcement. You know, there's a sense of knowing how things would be better than the perfect way to do it, right? And so that what's really challenging is, can I release the need to be in control? Can I release the need to things be to be perfect? Right? And so that brings up that a much deeper release, deeper root system to release. And as you do that, then naturally equanimity starts to rise. That, okay, this is not the way I would have done it, but this is okay. Thank you. Yes.
So I just wanted to ask something that's been kind of running through my mind.
Okay.
The Buddha's path is from suffering to non-suffering. So does every decision made in investigation relate to that question?
Yes. So the question is, the Buddha's path is from suffering to the end of suffering, and so investigation, does everything relate to that question? Does this lead to more suffering or to the release of suffering? And I would say yes. I'd say that's kind of the wise view and the wise intention that come in that really orients our whole practice. Right, so I mean, ideally, everything, every time we sit down, every action we do, every investigation that we do, it has this much bigger perspective. Does this lead to the end of suffering? Right, and so there's different ways we can frame that end. I tend to frame it from seeing through the illusion of self. Right, so that's kind of that really helps me get a lot of purchase on that question. What does the end of suffering mean? It may mean something different for you, and that's wonderful to find what resonates. But I think that investigation, that deeper perspective of the overall arcing purpose of practice, why do we practice, that really clarifies a lot of things. It helps clean up the tendency to use investigation to add more story, to add more proliferation. Yeah. Does that help? You're welcome. All right. We probably should stop because I have a few announcements. So thank you again for your sincere intention. Thank you for the questions, because that really does, you can see it highlights aspects of the talk, and we can go places. And also it's inspiring when people talk about how their practice is working. You know, it's like it brings that sense of confidence that this works. All right, so Peter has a few announcements.